if you will, to 1 Timothy chapter 3, or you might stick your finger over in Titus chapter 1. We'll be kind of going back and forth just a little bit. You recall that we have been studying at the request of the men in the business meeting in regard to the matter of eldership, and we have been contemplating the matter of the qualifications of elders as the New Testament lays them down, and we continue that this morning. For those of you who are visiting that are rather old familiar friends, we are always happy to see you and have you back in our place of assembly. For those of you who are here for the very first time, we want you to know that we are appreciative of your willingness to come, accepting the invitation that has been extended. Those of you who are traveling and passing through, that your faith is of such a nature that your desire is to worship with the people of God. And we trust that you'll give us an opportunity to get better acquainted with you before you leave our assembly this morning. Not a real visitor, and yet one that needs to be noted in our presence this morning, is Brother Gene Cusick. Brother Gene has had back surgery. He's been in Panama for almost a year now, stationed there, and is home. He is with us during our assembly this morning. I wanted to make sure that all of us who are members here at Knollwood were aware of that. Gene indicated he might not be able to sit through the entire service. He might have to stand up and move around, and I told him that'd be fine. And so if you look for him, why, you might find that he's having to kind of move around a little bit because of the surgery that he's had. And we're grateful that all of that went so well. We just wish that all of us could have been much closer to have provided the kind of support and presence that is so needful in times like that. Also, it's good that Sister Catherine Burris is with us this morning. John remains at Miami Valley Hospital. He hopes, unless something has changed, to be able to be released tomorrow or Tuesday. And things have worked well and favorable again there, and it's good to have Catherine out this morning. We're going to look at just one thing this morning. I want to give us basically a bird's eye view of the qualifications of elders. And yet, to be honest with you, the one that we look at this morning in regard to elders and faithful children is one that I guess probably has evoked more discussion and application than maybe any of the others among us. It seems to me that wisdom would dictate that the best thing that we could try to do is to contemplate some of the considerations that are involved. There are at least three major areas of controversy that surround the subject of elders and faithful children, and at least they need to be laid out, and we need to spend some time contemplating these things. I think everybody would agree that the text in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6 says that an elder is to be one having faithful children. And in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 4, it says having his children in subjection. I freely admit that not all brethren agree in the application and the requirement as it pertains to those two statements. I also realize that there are many honest brethren who are on both sides of the controversy. I likewise am not so naive as to think that I alone can settle the issue. I am not naive enough to think that whatever we're going to study this morning will be the thing that would convince anybody who may necessarily see otherwise. What I want us to do in my desire this morning is to try to present some thoughts for study that might help us to reflect upon what at least potentially is there and how it may be applied, that only good may come. I view our study this morning probably a little different than most of the times I preach, and that is I see it more as a Bible-type study situation, and I would encourage you to listen carefully and think in regard to what the text says, that we might try to come to some understanding about elders and faithful children. When I state that there are basically three controversies that brethren have raised in regard to this matter, let me begin with probably for most of us the easiest one, and that is the one that says that an elder must have or possess children. That sounds peculiar, I think, to probably all of us here at Knollwood, and yet there are those who contend that the expression is that if he have children, it means then that they must be in subjection, they must not be accused of riot or unruly, and that it is only if he have children. that the only qualification given for an elder is blameless. We've talked about this and tried to show why it's not so. But the idea is that if he is, the only qualification is that he is blameless, then he has to be blameless in these particular kind of areas. And if he does not have any children, then obviously he's qualified because he's blameless in that area. And it's not saying that he has to be a man who is married any more than it says he has to be a man who has children. I would suggest to you, however, that the wording of both Titus 1 and 1 Timothy chapter 3 will not support that. Titus 1 and verse 6 says, if any, the husband of one wife, having faithful children. And in 1 Timothy 3, verses 2 and 4, a bishop must be the husband of one wife, having his children in subjection with all gravity. It would be difficult, at least for me, to imagine how this could be said with more force or more clarity than that. The real issue before us this morning in regard to faithful children needs to be grasped. And I would suggest to you that what that is stated in the parenthetical expression of 1 Timothy 3 and verse 5. He says, for if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Men, we need to understand that our homes are our proving grounds. It is the place of test. It is the place of trial. If you will, using a military concept, it is basic training. If we fail in our homes, and what this says is, we are going to have to be active as men in those homes. We are not going to be able to commit or turn over the responsibility of our homes to our companions and say, you take care of it. God does not say that anywhere. A man who is not actively involved in the discipline of his children is not going to be able to serve in the capacity of an elder because he's not proven himself in that area where his own children are concerned, and he's going to have to prove himself in that area because that's going to be a part of what he's going to do at times as an elder in the church of the Lord. The same is so in regard to the spiritual education and leading and training and development of his children. We who are fathers, I know we've got a responsibility to provide an honest living for our families. I know that takes most of us out of our homes a goodly number of hours of every week. But we cannot roll in and roll down in front of the tube, there in the easy chair and kick the recliner up, or lay down on the couch and when we're not snoozing or reading the paper or watching the tube, be totally disinterested and removed from our families. We have some responsibilities to the training and the education, particularly spiritually, of our children. Our wives, many of them, get the greatest amount of credit that could ever possibly and potentially be for the way most of our children have turned out. By virtue of the time that they have spent and the successful efforts that so often they have done. But Scripture in Ephesians 6, for example, or Colossians 3, demonstrates that we must likewise be active. And if I see anything in regard to what this family requirement is concerning, it is not the fact that he is handsome enough, or personable enough, or witty enough, or charming enough to be able to woo successfully the hand of some young woman. It is not the fact that he possesses the ability to be reproductive. That is not the point under consideration. It is his ability to lead and guide and train and educate and teach in those spiritual areas, particularly where his family is concerned. And basically what Paul says there in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 5 is, if we have failed in our home, then we would fail in the church of God, and that man is not qualified to serve in that kind of a capacity. You see, I could not see then how that a man could demonstrate his ability to rule well in his own house if he didn't have a wife, if he didn't have children. Most certainly, the qualifications will demand that a man has to learn to rule well his own self, doesn't it? I mean, many of those qualities are qualities that are inward qualities that demand the self-discipline that ruling one's own spirit and disposition and activities affect. But there are some that affect other than that. And so this very first idea that if he hath children, then they have to be this, but it doesn't mean he has to have children. The language couldn't be any plainer. He not only must have children, he must have whatever are identified as faithful or believing children, and that is controversy number two, isn't it? What constitutes faithful or believing children? Does this require that an elder's children be Christians themselves who are faithful to God? And again, as surprising as that may seem to some of us, there is some controversy here, for some suggest that the expression having his children in subjection with all gravity and not accused of riot and unruly only relates to the domestic relationship. In other words, it only relates to the home. It is argued that as long as a man's children believe in him and are faithful to him and the requirements he may lay down for the oversight of his own home, he is then qualified. I would assume, surely, that all of us who are here have those kind of qualities where our homes are concerned. We do in ours. We sometimes try to reinforce that upon all three of our children by simply saying, as long as you live under our roof, you are going to abide by our rules. Whenever you branch out and ultimately reach the age of maturity where you can have your own home, if you choose to have different rules than your mother and I have, you can make your own rules. But as long as you abide in this house, under this headship, and under this leadership, you are going to abide by our rules. And you know, some would say as long as that's done, while they're there, that qualifies a person. That may say, as we have certainly told ours, though we are not depending on just telling them, but rather trying to teach them from the Word of God, and to set the kind of example before them, and to try to answer their questions why others are not as faithful and dedicated and diligent in the cause of Christ as they ought to be, just like you have done or are doing in your homes, that there is a rule that says, as long as you abide under our roof, when it comes time to worship with the people of God, there is nobody who needs to say, do we have to go? Must we go? Why should we go? Who's going to go? It's just naturally understood that we are the children of God, and at those appointed times when brethren come together to worship him, where else would we be? And I think that's a good question for some of the rest of us, particularly some of us in this assembly who do not feel a great sense of duty or responsibility to being in our assemblies on Wednesday evenings or Lord's Day evenings. Where else would you be? What else are you doing? What is more important than the worship of God? There must be something, because there is the significant gap here, as there is everywhere, that I know anything about in between those periods of services. We need to establish those kind of principles. We need to educate our children in those kind of principles. It'll go a long way in helping them to recognize responsibilities that God has laid down. But you see, some say, okay, Bill, you've got that kind of rule. As long as your kids are there, that would qualify you. And yet, as soon as they leave home, if they choose never to darken the door again, as we sometimes say, that wouldn't legislate against you. Now, I would argue against that very, very clearly, because I think it shows what I've said before. There are two kinds of rule in the home. One is a rule that is basically a force. It is the rule with which I still tell, especially my boys, because they're young, because I said so, because I'm bigger than you are, because I'm the daddy, because I'm the head of this house. That's why. But there has to be the passing from that kind of rule, which says even as long as you live in this house, when it comes time to worship, you're going to be in worship. You have no option. You're going to be in worship, or you're not going to be in this house. You see, that's one kind of rule. The other kind is the kind of gentle moral persuasion. It is the kind where you've taught the principles and the concepts that are in the Word of God, and you've instilled them and planted them in their hearts to where that's what they want to do because they want to do it. Both of those kinds of rule have to be there. And to be honest with you, the one that really demonstrates whether we're doing our job or not is not the one that says, because I said so. It is the one that shows itself when that one gets out and gets to make the decisions on their own, and they make those decisions, and the decisions that are made are the decisions of God, because it shows that that rule has been properly exercised. As you look here then, I would suggest that even if you take this idea of it means then that only believing or faithful relates to the domestic relationship, that it produces some difficulties in other places. If you look at the same word used in some other passages very close here to where we're looking, for example, in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 11, when he turns his attention here to those who are the wives of both elders and deacons, contextually, I think that would be so. One of the things that is said is that they are to be faithful in all things. Now, does that mean that she is only to be faithful to her husband? Not that she has to be a faithful Christian? I don't know anybody among us who would accept that. And yet, if the other is true, that could be true. What about 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2? The things that thou hast learned of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Does that mean that these people just have to be faithful to their teacher, not that they have to be faithful Christians? You and I know as well as we know anything, surely, that it's only faithful Christians who are going to try to teach anybody. If a person's not a very faithful Christian, they don't do much teaching because they have not any commitment to the Lord. So it's not a matter of just being faithful to their teacher. Or what about 1 Timothy 6 and verse 2 that talks about believing masters? And in the context, as you read on, you can see who are brethren. That pretty well seems to settle the idea that faithful or believing that are dealt with in this passage indicates that we're not talking about a relationship to the physical father, but we are talking about a relationship that we sustain before God. And so, what we are basically trying to look at then is that Paul was saying that an elder must be a man who has children who are believers, who are Christians. And such a man has demonstrated that he can teach and guide and lead his own family in spiritual matters. And if a man cannot accomplish this in his own family, as Paul says in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 5, how could he ever accomplish that in the church of God? Now that brings up a rather interesting question. And that is, what about apostate children? What about children who leave the Lord after they've left the home? Well, again, there are basically two positions. One says the children only have to be faithful while they are under their father's roof. But it would be unreasonable to charge the father with unfaithfulness after they are out and on their own. Those who take this position generally support the idea by looking at God and saying God cannot be charged for the unfaithfulness of those who are his children in whatever dispensation of time you want to look. And so, for example, they will say, Adam and Eve, did they not have the power of choice? And when they exercised their choice and they sinned in the garden, was God responsible for their choice? And everybody would say, no, that what it is the exercise of free moral agency. Sometimes Isaiah 2 and verse 2 is cited that says, for God, I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. Who would say that God did not do his job well, or this wouldn't have happened? Who would say that God is the one who was responsible here? And the argument generally is it reasonable or just to argue that God would not be responsible for the misdeeds of his children, but elders are responsible for the misdeeds of their children? And the point that they're always trying to make is this, that if the elder's children were faithful while they were under his rule in the house, while they lived at home, then he meets this qualification. I personally have a problem with that. My problem is a problem of logic. It is a problem of syllogism. The argument that is made is an argument that works itself like this. And I'm going to, instead of God, use deity. And because God's children are human, humanity. And when you look at that, basically what they're saying is, here's God, and God is not responsible for the activities of their children. All right? What you have down here, however, is the elder who is human and his children who are human. And my problem with all of this is, it's not parallel. There is a logical fault that says that we are reasoning from a syllogism that says, if this and if this, therefore then, this. The problem is, I know without any question of a doubt that when man fails to be what he ought to be as the child of God, you can never blame God. Because God being God is absolutely perfect. Everything that ever was needed or necessary or needful was supplied, because it was not supplied by the frailty of man, but by the perfection of God. But down here, these two do not equate. I don't care how anybody looks at anybody who's an elder, and I've known some great ones. None of them have ever claimed to be God. And here, you cannot parallel the two. And therefore, I cannot accept the conclusion based upon that kind of a concept. I do think that there is some consideration that needs to be made along this line. But I think that that's the wrong approach to make towards it. Let me see if I can lay it out here. You take a home in which there is a father and a mother. I might have should have used husband and wife. And here, say they've got three children. While they're in the home, they're faithful, dedicated children of God. Let me ask you. While these three children are in the home, who is the head of that home? Who is their head? Well, I think everybody here surely recognizes that this husband or this father is that head, right? All right, now let me show you something. What happens when this young man comes out here at an age where he is responsible, and he finds a young woman, and they get married? And they set up their own home. Question. Who is his head? Is it his father? Or, because there has been the formation of his own home, does the Bible teach rather that he is the head of his own house? Look at it again. Here's a young lady. She goes out and meets that young man and forms her own home. Who is her head? Is her daddy her head? Or is her head her husband in her own home? You see the point? If I'm going to argue this position, I'm not going to argue it from a logical sense that is fallacy, because it doesn't equate. I will argue it from this kind of a position. I will also qualify it. I will qualify it to say this. If my great artistic ability here, if this young man who comes out here and forms this home has been faithful as a Christian while he lived in the home of his father, but now that he's out here and formulated his own, as soon as he formulates that, he goes into apostasy. He turns his back on God. He has nothing to do with the Church of the Living God whatsoever. Question. What does that tell you about this young man, not only here, but back up here? And what does it tell you about the bearing of that father? I think that has bearing. I think that has to be looked at differently from this situation. You understand? I get to make the hypothetical situations here, so I'm going to make them easy for me, okay? Here's the young lady who's left this home. We've established that her husband is now her head and not her father. Rather than immediately, 15 years after this home has been formulated, and into which maybe a couple of children have been born, for example, one of these children are very tragically taken in an accident, by disease. And this young woman turns her back on God, blames him, and rails against God and says, if that's the way God is going to treat my innocent little child who was deserving of nothing, I don't even believe there is a God. Now, I've seen this. I've seen this happen. I've seen this happen in the homes of people who are Christians. 15 years later, is that parallel to this immediate situation? And I would say no. There has been ample time in which the faithfulness of this one has been demonstrated. Maybe the circumstances that have arisen in that home, over which this father, who is no longer her head anyway, had no control. And it has a different bearing on the case in application. The second idea that is so often produced in regard to this matter of apostate children is Proverbs 22 and verse 6. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Period. Absolute rule. In other words, I don't care if it's 115 years later. I don't care if there are mitigating circumstances or not. As far as I'm concerned, if they ever apostatize, it is the fault of this father and this mother. That's the position that many have taken on Proverbs 22 and verse 6. I will freely admit, I know I'm sticking my neck out every time I talk about these things, to be chopped off. That's not new. And I don't want to get sidetracked into a discussion of Proverbs 22 and verse 6, but I do not accept that. I do not accept that because the rule is basically established in Proverbs 22 and verse 6. The exception is not dealt with, but there are exceptions to that rule. All you've got to do is look at the author of it, and you see exceptions of it. And at the same time, there are other passages similar to it in which maybe we can see the point a little easier. Case in point, 1 Timothy 2 and verse 15. Paul says, a woman is saved in childbearing. Is that absolute? Are there no exceptions to that? If we're going to take that very literally, then what that's saying is that if any family, any couple, a woman is never able to produce offspring, she cannot be saved. Now you know as well as I do that that's foolishness, because that's not what is involved in salvation to start with. He's making an entirely different kind of argument in 1 Timothy chapter 2 to begin with. And he's not saying that unless a woman has a child, she's going to be lost eternally. That's not the point of the passage, and it's a wild application of it if we try to make it that way. But I'm not going to get sidetracked onto that text and context either. But to use it because I think you can readily see that there are exceptions to the rule. If we take the absolute idea of Proverbs 22 and verse 6, it would seem to me that this is what we would have to do, and it presents a very vicious circle. Would we not have to say we could never appoint any man an elder until all of his children have died? Because as long as he lived, if one of them would ever apostatize, then that man would have never been qualified because he would have been responsible for failing to teach them. And so after all these children are dead, then and only then could he serve as an elder, which only produces the fact of somebody jumping up and saying, wait a minute, it says he has to have believing children and he doesn't have any now. And so you're never going to have them. And that's what happens when we get into this kind of approach toward these things. I see a very definite difference between saying a man is responsible for the misdeeds of his children and saying that a man is not qualified for the eldership or ought to step down from the eldership because of those misdeeds. Let me give you a situation or two to consider. I have no trouble concluding that an elder should resign or a man should not be considered for the eldership if his children's unfaithfulness bring reproach upon the church and or destroy his influence and or destroy his ability to rule well, his credibility. If a man is in that position, it matters not how desperately we may wish to have elders. Effectively, that will not work because there are those who will not follow that lead. Here is a situation where somebody has a child that's not been right. If it destroys their influence, if it questions in the minds of a significant number of brethren over whom he would have rule, his ability to have ruled and ruled well, or destroy his influence in the process, then he's either going to have to step down or he's going to have to say, I choose not to serve. And that for the benefit, really, of himself and the church. And that's hard. I know it is, but there are harder things. And there are still plenty of areas to serve in and to serve very successfully in the church of the Lord. They need those efforts fulfilled just as desperately as we do the other. I know a church right now that is going through problems with their eldership. One has resigned. The rest of them ought to. I've known that for years. I know this situation very intimately and have known it for years. Probably they won't. While I was away at Thanksgiving, I happened to see somebody from that area and just inquired, knowing some difficulties that were there, what they thought. Was it going to be able to be worked out? And the statement was, I doubt it. There was the man who resigned 10 years ago, asked the local preacher, because his child that was out of the home but living in the area was acting in an ungodly manner, should I resign? And the preacher said, yes. And I just guarantee you, you know what happened. The preacher couldn't stay another year after that because he refused to resign. But he had no influence, no leadership in that church. He couldn't talk to anybody because every time he'd go to sit down to talk in somebody's home, they'd tell him rather pointedly, go straighten up your own home before you come over here and try to straighten up mine. And I think some of them had a point, and he finally decided he needed to resign. That's the idea I'm talking about. I do think, again, that there's another consideration. If that unfaithful child is far removed from the church where that man serves or seeks to serve, and where maybe the actions of that apostate child are unknown, at least to the majority of the church, and in no way involves it, that man could serve, simply because his influence is not being dealt with. Reproach is not being brought upon the church there. Now, let me ask you something. How does that equate with sin is sin? Ungodliness is ungodliness. It doesn't matter if it's right there in that community or if it's a California or Hawaii or China or wherever that kid's at. Sin is sin. That's right. Ungodliness and unrighteousness are ungodliness and unrighteousness wherever they are. But we're dealing now with a situation more like this, in which what we are trying to see is how it affects the influence of the man, and if it's going to affect him, or if he personally, and I've known a number of men who have stepped aside or refused to serve simply because of a child that is so far removed and nobody knows. And to this day, people talk about those and say, we don't understand why this man won't serve as an elder. He is so qualified. And the only reason he won't is because it's not known in the church where he is, except by maybe just a few of his friends on whose shoulder he cried. And as they tried to help him reach that child that had departed from the faith, it's not the general knowledge of that church. They can't understand, many of them, why he won't serve. But that's the reason. You have to respect the convictions of men like that. And that's part of it. Well, that raises one more issue that I think somewhere has to be dealt with. And there's a lot of things that's in this. What happens in this situation? If I can get it back up here. What happens in this situation? Well, what we get is, here's a man, he's serving as an elder. This child has already left and gone out of the house. Maybe this child is ready to, or maybe they're off in college somewhere, and all of a sudden it's one of those situations that we joke about, that there's Abraham and Sarah. And all of a sudden, after basically you've got an empty nest, here comes a newborn. That child's not a Christian. Now, should he step down? Or in a case where brethren are considered, should he not serve? Well, I would suggest here that what we look at is that we understand that first, we're dealing with those where there is already a plurality of believing children. Both of these are faithful Christians. He has demonstrated his ability to rule in this situation. And for example, maybe one, or in some instances, maybe both of them are in their own homes now. I don't have an easy solution to that. I know some cases where that's happened. And I know some cases where those men were able to serve. I know some cases where they stepped down because of their own personal convictions. I know some cases where they were men. I'm talking about real men. Because they stepped down because of the consciences of a few brethren. And their idea was this. We were successful here and here. It's just a few years. We can be successful again. And the brethren, without any questions in the minds of anybody, will say you're qualified to serve. You'll serve again. And that's the spirit and the disposition that you look for in a man who serves as an elder. Well, that brings me to the last one, and I'm out of time. I'd try to quit, but I don't think you'd let me, because I do want to get all of it over with. It's probably the only one we've really thought seriously about when we came in here, and I said we were going to talk about elders and faithful children. And that is the idea of the child children controversy. Is child inherent in children? When you look at this, we are told the word is children. For some, that settles it. It says children. Children is plural. That settles it. Others have looked at it and said, well, that's the safe course. After all, with children, you have a plurality of different personalities to work with and that you have ruled over. And that's true, isn't it? I mean, which of us are parents, especially who here whose parents who've had more than one child, have not looked and said, there are times I'm not really sure that this can be our kid, because this kid is so different than this kid. And in our family, I always say, and he takes after your side of the family. And she says it right back. But you see, there is substance to that, isn't there? Because in a church, even like this, we're not all exactly the same. We don't have the same background. We don't have the same social standing. We don't have the same educational standing. There are differences that are a part of who and what we are. And there are different kinds of approaches, just like there are with children, that work in dealing with different kinds of personalities. Somebody else looks at it and says, well, I'll say this. This is the uncomplicated reading of the phrase. If you say the child is inherent in children, while that's not major complication, nonetheless what that says is, but it's more complicated than just simply saying that the uncomplicated reading says it's children. I've heard brethren say, well, I'm willing to say that maybe child, or even I'm willing to say that child is inherent in children, but I don't think that's wise. And I don't think that's wise because if this couple would have had more than one child, then maybe they wouldn't have done as well with child number two as they did with child number one. After all, if you only have one child, all of your time, all of your interest, all of your devotion, all of your efforts can be directed just to one. And everybody here that's got more than one knows full well, one's a handful. All of us know that. But everybody that's here that's got more than one knows that you got to divide yourself up a little bit more when you got more than one. And not one does not get all of the time and the attention and the interest and the devotion that just one would get. But the fallacy of that is, where has God ever held us responsible for what we don't have? He only holds us responsible for what we do have. If I only have one, that's all I'll answer for. If I have three, that's all I'll answer for. I've got a cousin that married into a family that had 13. They're going to answer for more than I am. Some of you come from big families. There was more to answer for there than even you yourself, because you didn't have as many. But God doesn't hold me responsible for what I have not been committed to. Now, I want you to understand that when we look at what I am freely willing to accept, and that is that child is inherent in children. And yes, I believe that a man who has only one faithful Christian, who is faithful to God, can serve as an elder. I am not dogmatic. If you disagree, I certainly will not argue. Generally, the case I found is you want to argue with me. And I just try to look at your position, and I'm willing to say that if that's how you see it, then I certainly think that that's a very viable position. I don't think it's consistent with everything that the Scripture reveals about the matter, but I'm willing to accept that. If that's the thinking of the brethren, a man with only one child would be unwise, even if he was asked to serve, because only controversy would arise from that. And there's no need for that, not in an area sensitive as this. The reason why I believe that child is inherent in children is because as you study through the Scriptures, you can see a number of instances where the plural is used for the singular and the singular is used for the plural. Let me use a couple of illustrations. In Genesis 8 and verse 4, we are told that the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. Now, if you read the dimensions of the ark, it was a pretty big structure, but it wasn't big enough to rest on two mountains at one time when it stopped. The mountains is the range, like we would talk about the Appalachians or the Rockies. And it rested on one mount in that particular range of mountains. And that's all that's being said there. A little later, in Genesis chapter 19 and verse 29, we're told that God destroyed the cities of the plain in which Lot dwelt. Now, I don't know about Lot, but I've learned about me. I can only live in one city at a time. If God would destroy the cities of the Miami Valley, Dayton, Miamisburg, Fairborn, Kettering, Beaver Creek, it might be said that God destroyed the cities of the Miami Valley in which Jim Pugh dwelt. Well, all of us know Jim Pugh can only dwell in one of those cities at a time. Now, maybe Lot had dwelt in both of those cities or all of those cities that were in the plain that got destroyed at various times. But when God destroyed it, only one at a time. And so you see it again. In Genesis 1 and verse 20, in the creation, God created the moving creature and fowl, singular, but obviously the plural is referred to all creatures and all fowl. Somebody says, well, that's not quite fair because that's not children. And that's a very valid point. I'm trying to show that sometimes in various areas you see this kind of usage. But it's only valid if we can find it in that particular area that we're looking at, isn't it? Is this ever used in regard to children anywhere other than where we want to try to find it? And I suggest to you the answer is yes. In Genesis 21:7, about Sarah, it is said that Sarah should have given children, and it is the plural in both the translation and the original Hebrew, suck. And yet everybody who knows Bible history about the life of Abraham and Sarah knows this. Sarah only had one child. She didn't have more than one, only had one. Or if you look, for example, in Matthew 22 and verse 24, when this man sets up a situation he doesn't believe in anyway, because he doesn't believe in the resurrection to start with, but he sets one up trying to trap Jesus. He talks about the man who dies and his wife is left without any children, plural. If you will go back, and he uses that situation seven times, if you will go back and look at the original, where it comes from, Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5, it is the singular that's used. Does that mean that here's a fella who died and had one child, but because he didn't have more than one, his brother could marry and raise up seed to his brother? No. Once the one child was born, that was the one through whom the seed was raised up into the brother's name and perpetuated the inheritance and everything else. Look at it a little closer maybe to our text. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4, about widows indeed, Paul says, but if any widow have children, plural, or nephews, plural, let them first learn to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. If the plural excludes the singular, then does not consistency demand in this passage in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 4 that a widow with one child be taken into the role of the number of those who would be supported by the local church? And the whole point of that passage is that the reason she is taken in and her support is provided is because she has nobody else who can care for. She has no children, not child or children plural, nephew or nephews. She's by herself. That's why this arrangement was made by God. And it is because of this that I'm willing to accept the position that child is inherent in children. I am not dogmatic on it at all. I believe it is consistent, however, with Bible teaching. Somebody asked me, I've been asked about this probably since the first study we made about eldership by a variety of different people, if I knew of anybody in that position, and I said no. In the last 2 weeks, because last week we took a week off of this kind of study for others, I freely admit that I have done an awful lot of studying and an awful lot of thinking and meditating and reflection about the information that's in Scripture and cases that I've known. And I must retract that to those of you that I said, and I should have known better then, because I know somebody very well who only has one child who serves as an elder. And to enhance that, it's not even his child. And there were objections. If the man is elder qualified, if he is elder material, with those objections, he would not serve. He will not seek to create the problem rather than to force his own liberty in the matter. There's one more thing about this I want to say. And I think I can say it in a way that everybody will grasp and probably nobody's thinking about. Okay? When we talk about child being inherent in children, we are only talking about a situation where they only have one child. We are not talking about a family like me. Since we started talking about eldership, surely nobody has thought about me. But I have a child who is Christian, but I have two that are not. This child inherent in children does not apply to me or anybody in my position. It applies only to those who only have one child. That person proved themselves with all they had, one child. This person, like me, is going to have to prove that I can be successful, if I ever can, with two boys. As so far we have been with one girl. And that's my conviction on the matter. There are a lot of other things that could have been said. I have tried to deal with the basic issues that confront us. As I said, I am not naive enough to think that I can solve all issues, because I can't. All I can do is try to do what you can do, and that's what I'm asking you to do. And that is to get the book out, dust it off, spend some time with it, look at what Scripture says, think about it, meditate on it. Work it out. See how it applies. Because really that's what God expects out of all of us anyway where Bible study is concerned. I have tried to be as honest as I could. I told you in the very beginning of our study, some of these things are controversial. And because of that, I recognize that there are times that the things that I believe by my study of the Scripture about these applications are different than what others believe. I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to not be dogmatic. I believe what I have concluded by virtue of my study. I'm willing to consider other considerations or points of view and to try to be as honest and open, as fair as I can be about it. I do know this. This is probably the one area that produces not only the greatest amount of controversy in the matter of elders, but it is probably the one, short of men who have no desire for the office, that disqualifies more men from serving as elders than any of the others. And you know what that says? On the positive side, it says that we really, fathers, need to be working hard with our families. God expects it. He's telling us that this is a part of the proving of the training ground for greater use and service in His vineyard and in His kingdom. And if it says anything to me or to you this morning, and especially to those of us who are younger and who may be working toward the development of these, you've got to start early. Because this kind of leading and training and education and whatnot just doesn't happen overnight. And it just doesn't happen late in life. You've got to start early. You've got to build those lines of communication, and you've got to keep them open. You've got to be there, and your kids have got to know that you're there. They've got to see in you Jesus Christ. What this says is, again, the great importance that's seen in the home, in the family. Whether we're working toward eldership, or whether we're just working for strong, stable, secure homes, only God will be blessed in these kind of circumstances. Because I know this, there has never been an objection raised yet against the family where there has been definite godliness manifested in the rearing of those children. And I thank God that I know a good number of those kind of people in a variety of places, because you are the kind of people that sustained Cherie and I and other young families as they try in the world in which we're living today to successfully rear our children. And we thank you for it. Without you, we might throw up our hands in despair and quit. It doesn't go unnoticed whether you ever get to the point that you serve as an elder or not. But if you're ever going to serve, that's what has to be. Well, I've gone over time. I apologize just about that much. Most of you know I don't apologize too much for going over time, but I have this morning. But I wanted to get it said, and I didn't know any way to say it any faster than I could say it, and I don't want it to come across that I'm stomping and so dogmatic about it that it's this or nothing, because there is some room for latitude in application of some of these things. If you're here this morning as somebody